Welcome to The Bike Show, the original and sometimes the best cycling podcast in the known universe. If not the most frequent these days, a state of affairs for which I apologise. But this is a bumper edition in which I'll be riding the snow-clad hills of Mid Wales with Emily Chappell, the country girl turned London bike messenger, turned long-distance cycle tourist, turned author, turned ultra-endurance racer. But before that, a story that is like a huge cake made out of 100% good, frosted with pure sparkling good, with half a pound of good piled on top. It starts, however, with a bit of bad news from a few years ago, when Britain's Royal Mail, the National Postal Service, decided that it didn't want its postmen and postwomen delivering the mail by bike, preferring vans or trolleys that you push along the pavement. This decision left a fleet of postal bikes going begging. Surely someone could find a use for them. That's where a small social enterprise working in Malawi in southern Africa stepped in. A little while ago, at the London Bike Show, I asked Georgina Furnival of the Krizivac Project to fill me in on how she's turning post bikes into elephant bikes.
The elephant bike is a refurbished postal bike, ex-British postal bike. The Royal Mail phased them out of service some years ago, and we're a charity. We've been collecting them from all around the country over the last few years to ship to our projects in Malawi in Africa. So they're excellent bikes for Africa. They're so sturdy, they need very little maintenance, and they're life transforming. When they arrive in Africa, you can start a business if you own a bike. So that's what we do. We get bikes out to Africa.
So these are the bikes that postmen and postwomen would have ridden around on for years, but the Royal Mail got out of running a fleet of bicycles. Why did they stop having postmen and postwomen on bikes?
To the best of my knowledge, it was because the way we've used the postal service has changed. We send fewer letters, we send more parcels, and bikes aren't really suitable for that kind of service. So yeah, they were getting rid of them, and that was a problem to Royal Mail, what to do with that many bikes.
How many were there?
In total across the country, there were just over 20,000. Another charity down in the southeast had quite a few, and we had the remainder because we were able to collect nationwide.
So how many ex-Royal Mail postal bikes have you got?
We collected around 20,000. I mean, it's not an exact science. We've shipped around 8,000 to Malawi so far. Shipping bikes to Malawi is a costly business. It costs us around £10,000 for every container we send, and you can fit about 300 bikes in a container. So it's an expensive business, and Royal Mail kindly gave us permission to sell a limited edition of the bikes in the UK, as long as we refurbished them, rebranded them, recoloured them, and that's where Elephant Bike came along. So we are working with a local Youth Offenders Institute, so prisoners are helping us to do up the bikes. And they come back to our bike workshops for their final CITEC check. And then we're selling them. And for every bike sold, it pays to ship another one out to Malawi.
So you buy a bike, the consumer in the UK, and the price you pay pays for your own bike, which is fully refurbished and repainted and checked out, as well as another bike to go to Malawi.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And when they reach Malawi, they're actually sold low cost. And that money there funds our children's centre and primary school. That's the exciting part of the project for me.
And you're doing it for what seems to me to be an amazing price, given what this bike is. I mean, we've got an elephant bike in front of us here. It's in a kind of dark khaki green colour, I suppose. They come in various different colours you've got on the stand. This bike was made in Britain for the Royal Mail by, who made it? Was it Pashley, I think?
Yeah, they were made by Pashley for Royal Mail.
So they are a British-made cargo bike, essentially. You've got the big carrier on the front, the kind of butcher-style carrier on the back, and then you've got a very, very long sort of rear pannier rack on the back there. When these bikes arrive in Africa, what will they be used for in Africa, in Malawi?
In Africa, they're used for getting goods to market. They're used as bicycle taxis. So you'll actually see bikes with seats on the back carrier, and you can fit a family of four on the back of there. They're used for getting to work, for getting to college. They're properly life-transforming. There's studies that show household income levels rise by 35% if a family owns a bike, which is huge when you're living below the poverty line.
And they're very sturdy, obviously, in construction, and they've got components which are very low maintenance, aren't they? Do you want to talk us through the gears and the brakes?
Absolutely, yeah. Perfect for Africa and the UK. They're very low maintenance, very sturdy and robust brakes and gearing system. They're drum brakes, three gears, all Sturmey Archer. It makes them very easy to ride, very easy to carry weight. So you can carry 20 kilos on the front carrier and an additional 20 kilos on the back. You don't really notice that weight once you get going because of the great design of the bikes. Perfect for the UK and for Africa as well.
And so, yeah, the wheels are very sturdy. There's a 24-inch wheel on the front and I think 26 on the back, right, give you room for that big carrier. And then obviously with the drum brakes and the internal hub gear, you've got very little exposed machinery, very few spare parts required. So these are bikes that are going to last and last and last, which is kind of why the Royal Mail chose them in the first place.
Absolutely, yeah. Very low maintenance, very long lasting.
And so the ones that you are selling in this country, what are they being used for?
In this country, we're finding people are using them for commuting, for shopping, town use mainly. What's been surprising for me is the amount of people that are buying them and saying, we're buying this to stop ourselves using a car. And so we're intending to do our main weekly shop on this bike.
And we should come to the price, because I'm kind of saving the best till last, because you've described this wonderful bike, this wonderful project, the fact that you're not only buying a bike for yourself, but you're having one sent to Africa for the money that you pay. What does it cost to have one of these bikes?
It will cost you the grand total of £280, and that's delivered to your door in the UK.
I mean, that is phenomenal. That, I must say, that is just a phenomenally good price.
We worked really, really hard to keep that price low. We couldn't do it without the support we get from volunteers, without the support from the prisons, without the support we get from the people who donate the storage space to us. So there are some advantages we have as a charity, and that's helped us to keep the price low. The important thing for us was to get the remaining bikes to Malawi, and if it pays us to do that, then it's fulfilled its objective.
And so tell us a little bit about the people who help fix them up, because you mentioned that they're youth offenders, right? So what kind of people are they, and what are they getting out of this project?
Okay, we work with Youth Offenders in Swinfen Youth Offenders Institute. They've set up a bike workshop really in conjunction with us, they're local to us, so it happened at the same time. And they wanted something to give the youth offenders some confidence, some training, some skills that will help them be more employable on release. And young lads, they were, you know, keen as mustard to get going on bikes. It's something that appeals to such a lot of people. So they work in the bike workshop. They're gaining a SciTech qualification whilst they're doing the work on the bikes. That to us is really important. It's just about building as much good into these bikes as you can possibly do. We've got 5 warehouses in Staffordshire. The bikes are all stacked up in there. We sort out which bikes are suitable for refurbishment. We take them up to the prison. They strip them down to their component parts. We collect them again and we take them up to be shot blasted and powder coated. We collect them again and we take them back to the prison and they're rebuilt. And we collect them again and we bring them back to our workshops where they have their final check over, basically a pre-sale service, and sign off by our SciTech mechanics. And then we package them up and we post them out to people.
You've got 5,000 that you're planning to sell. How many have you sold so far?
We've sold around 500 so far. We only just started towards the end of last year. And obviously, we're a small charity and our production is limited by the size of the team that we have in place at the moment. We aim to refurbish around 100 a month. If we can do that, we'll be doing well.
So I guess the last remaining thing for me to ask you is, why are they called elephant bikes?
I'm glad you asked me that, because it's actually quite a good story. Our bike workshops in Malawi gave some of the bikes to the national park where they look after the elephants and the rhinos and everything else. And the wardens do a 30-mile-a-day walk to parole the perimeter fencing around the rhino sanctuary. It's to stop the elephants going into the rhino sanctuary. But as soon as they started doing it on their red Royal Mail bikes, the elephants started to chase them. And it wasn't, obviously, just not safe for them. So they sent them back to the bike workshops and they asked for them to be resprayed green, a bush-friendly colour. And that didn't startle the elephants so much, and they're much, much safer on their green bikes. And we just loved the story. And as we had to recolour the bikes anyway, we thought they could be elephant bikes. And we're quite happy to say you won't be chased by an elephant whilst riding one of our bikes.
I was talking about the elephant bike with Georgina Furnival of the Krizovec Project. And you might have guessed from the interview that I was impressed by the elephant bike. So impressed, in fact, that I bought one. I'll be sharing my experiences of how I'm getting on with the bike in a forthcoming show. And if you've got an elephant bike, I'd like to hear how you're getting on with it. Drop me a line. Bikeshow@resonancefm.com or on Twitter, I'm @JackThurston. Now, you may have noticed that there's something of a boom in new books about cycling right now. And in the past year, there's been not one, but three new books written by former London bike messengers. Being a bike messenger is a tough, tedious and incredibly poorly paid way to make a living in an increasingly expensive city. But you do get to ride your bike around London all day, and there's a strong community among messengers. And there's always been a hip underground messenger subculture. Though she was once destined to be an academic, Emily Chappell found herself working as a bike messenger. She fell in love with the job and stuck at it for 6 years before taking up long-distance cycle touring and more recently, ultra racing. Emily's book, entitled What Goes Around, lifts the lid on the fascinating world of London bike messengers, and you won't find a better account of the texture of bike messenger life. I went to visit Emily at her home in remotest mid Wales.
This is where I grew up. I haven't lived here for quite a long time. I just moved back at the grand old age of 33. And I've got this weird situation now where I know it really well. This is the place I know best in the world. But also I don't know it that well because I don't really know where all the roads are. I don't know which pub you go to locally. I'm getting to know the area as I would a new area. So there's that lovely contrast of familiarity and strangeness.
We're up on a sort of hillside, come up from the valley below, and there are hills all around us. Where are we going to go for a ride? We're going to go up.
So from where we stand here, this is more or less the view I see from my desk. That hill over there, that's to the west, I think. That's where I go cycling. So that's a long, brutal climb, and then you get up to the top and you can do a nice loop. This hill here, the near one, is the one I run up or hike up, and you get a very good view from the top there. It's a nice sort of hours round trip. And then up towards the back of the valley there, to the south, I think it is the wind farm. So what we're going to do is follow the road up the valley. It will eventually turn into a track. We will go up a very, very long, steep climb, which my father claims is unrideable. And I know one person who's ridden it, and I have not yet ridden it. So we can have some fun on that.
Well, the second person won't be me, I can assure you of that. Certainly not with the gearing that I've got on my mountain bike. It's massively overgeared with the hub gear, I'm afraid. But you're riding a fat bike.
Yeah, which is a bit heavier than usual, which is my excuse. And this is the hill of many excuses,
okay.
Basically.
The hill of many excuses. I love it. That sounds like that ought to have a Welsh translation. Did you grow up speaking Welsh in school and things like that? Because are we in Waliapura, the Welsh-speaking heart of Wales?
Not really. There are certain pockets around here, but one thing I've realised moving back is that Wales seems to be made up of very, very small pockets. And there's probably a pocket 5 miles up the road where they all speak Welsh and nothing but. But because I lived in my own pocket, that to me was a foreign country and that was a long way off and you never
went there. So you didn't have Welsh language in your primary school and secondary school around
here? Everybody has to learn Welsh. That's the law. So I learned it. I studied it for 11 years, I think. And I can read it on the signs, I can pronounce it very well. It doesn't hold any fears for me because I know a lot of people see all the consonants and just think, oh my God. But I can't actually speak Welsh. And now, of course, I regret it because at the time I was a teenager and I just thought, this is stupid. I'm going to focus on French. And now I do wish I'd focused a bit more on the Welsh.
So we're going to go up the hill of many excuses. Mm. And does that lead us to the wind farm?
Eventually. So it leads us up towards the wind farm. It crosses Glyndwr's Way and then there's a couple more. There's a slightly shallower climb, which after the hill of many excuses will feel like a flat pretty much. And then we'll get up to the wind farm and then we can tootle around there for a bit. And it should be beautiful today. I was up there the other day before it snowed and there was already quite a bit of snow. So this will be lovely. And then at the end, there's a, a nice fast descent, which I gave myself a nosebleed on the other day, and my father broke a rib on a little while ago. So, and then if we survive, we'll get a nice cup of tea.
So that's the
back.
Descent of much blood.
Yes, the descent of broken bones. well, hopefully we won't break any bones.
Yeah, well, I'm counting on you to keep me safe and sound. All right, well, let's get going.
I was traveling up the mountains one day, and suddenly I heard a voice come to I and say, yeah, yeah. Behold, I come quickly to pay every man according to the work that he have done. And I know that it was the one voice of the Most High.
Oh, we've made it to the top, and I'm imagining that you can hear the wind turbines going around and round. Emily is Instagramming her fat bike. How did you get to stand up like that?
I just kind of wedged it into the snow. The snow is about a foot deep, so it seems to be standing up of its own accord.
I'm not surprised that you know how to Instagram your fat bike in the snow, having ridden it from where to where?
Anchorage to Seattle.
So that's a long way through Alaska and Canada.
Yeah, most of it was in Canada, actually. I did a couple of weeks in Alaska, then I went through Yukon and British Columbia.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, here we are at the top. Give us the tour of the horizon.
The guided tour. Well, I don't know all of it, but I mean, we can see for miles from here. Over there to the sort of the north-northeast is Aran Vaudhvi, the big snowy ridge you can see there. You can see Cadair Idris. I think it's kind of over there. I don't think that's it. So it's behind the clouds at the moment. But you can see snowy hills and mountains on every horizon. And a little tiny smudge of green down in the valley there, but not much.
That's nice. I always like the way the first snow fades into the fields very, very gently, and it always looks incredibly textural, doesn't it? And over there to the south, where I've come from, is a Renaissance cloudscape, straight out of some kind of fresco, isn't it?
It's incredible, isn't it? This is one of the things I love about being up here. I love living in this place because I've got this weird thing that I like to be up high. So I like to come and stand on the tops of hills and look at clouds in the sky and look down on the world. And I don't know, probably shows I've got some kind of superior tendencies or something. I don't really know, but it's beautiful.
I asked you to bring me here because your book is called What Goes Around, and these windmills are clearly going around and around and around. It's a terrible joke.
I love it.
Aimlessly. Well, maybe not aimlessly, because they are fueling the country with green energy, electricity generated from the wind. Did you get tired of going round and round London and ready to sort of set sail and point your wheels to further afield? What led to the end of your life as a messenger?
I didn't get tired of going round London. I think it was more positively that I just wanted more and more and more, and I wanted to explore new places and challenge myself more. And I think you get into this sort of groove with couriering, like you love the sense of being on a mission and being on your bike and moving and having to go somewhere. And then in a more, I guess, macro sense, I always felt like I needed to be going somewhere. And once I kind of got my head around couriering, that sense of wanting to be going somewhere didn't have anywhere to go, as it were. So I decided to try and tackle bigger journeys, and it's still going on because I've now cycled across Asia, and that'll be enough for a lot of people. But now I'm trying to do really ridiculous journeys in the cold or very, very, very fast, and I think it's very unlikely that I will kind of stop with just one sort of cycling. There's always got to be something I'm chasing. I don't like being new to something, but I like the sense of being learning, you know, having just about got over the stupid stage and striving towards the stage where I'm good at it.
One thing I thought that was very interesting about your book was that though it does do all the telling what it's like to be a messenger, and that's all very beautifully done, if I may say so, I have kind of heard, listened to that sort of stuff before. I think maybe 10 years ago I'd sort of read about it, it would have been really eye-opening, but there is a lot of messenger culture out there now. There's a lot on the web. There's some great articles and a couple of great radio programs actually done a few years ago about it, featuring some of your colleagues. But the fact is that your book is actually not just about what it's like to be a messenger in London. It's sort of more of a personal story of, is it like a coming of age type of story in a way? And because there's, you know, you weave in all sorts of things about your state of mind, your love life, different aspects of your life that aren't about messengering. It's not just what it's like to be a messenger in London. You're sort of telling a story about country girl goes to the big city in a way. I think it really comes across that way.
I think maybe it does. I don't think I really want it to be read that way, but I think it's inevitable that people will read it that way. And in a sense, it is a sort of a coming of age, because couriering is how I find myself and how I kind of got on the track that I'm on today. But then I think my sense with a typical coming of age narrative is that you come of age and then that's it. And I feel like I've got so much further to go. And I think there were a lot of things that initially my editor sort of wanted me to put in the book, and stuff about my journey, my other journeys and things. And I'm thinking, no, but there's loads more to come. This isn't like the book about how Emily came of age and found herself on a bike, because I'm still finding myself on a bike. So, you know, there's going to be others.
You're going to string it out a bit longer.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be this long self-indulgent series. And, you know, then I discovered myself again on a mountain and then again in a desert.
We need to get off this hillside because I think it's getting pretty windy. Where are we going now? We go down a hill. Yeah, we're going to get down in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, we've got a little way till we get to the top, and it'll take longer than usual because it's quite snowy. So, yeah, we'll carry on along this way through a few more gates over the top, and then we'll go very fast downwards. We might fall off the edge, we might break a few noses or bruise a few ribs, but we'll be fine.
Great, I'll follow you.
All right.
Now, was that the hill of broken bones and spilt blood?
Yeah, this is where I gave myself a nosebleed the other day, and where Dad broke a rib, and where I gather you just had a tumble.
I just took a tumble. The snow, I was like the abominable snowman, totally white. I don't know what happened. It was one of those ones where you're just going down and suddenly you're eating snow, and bike's gone down the hill and you're on the floor.
It was very suddenly, I think, in the snow. There was one winter in London where there was snow on the ground for a really long time. And I remember one evening, it was a beautiful starry night, and I was riding on these roads that were like ice rinks. They were shining like pearls, and they were beautiful, and you had to be very careful. And you fall so quickly on ice that the first thing I knew of having fallen was lying on my back on the ice looking up at the stars, and then sort of putting two and together and realising that I must have fallen off the bike.
Yes, it almost feels like it might be somehow less dangerous in terms of breaking your wrist, or because you don't have time to brace yourself for your fall and get all tense, you're just on the floor instantly.
It's like when you're riding drunk. Not that I would ever do that, but if you were to ride drunk, you're less likely to injure yourself because you don't really notice what's going on.
It's nice, we've got the sun's come out again. We've dropped a few hundred feet, so it's a bit warmer and a lot less windy than it was up there. Although we've got one last sentinel of the forest of turbines going around on the top of that hill there, still making a bit of a racket,
overlooking us.
So as well as talking about being a messenger, which you do very well in the book, very beautiful writing and very evocative and interesting as well, you also tell a story about yourself and how being a messenger changed you. In the way that I read the book, that's an equal part of the book as, you know, what is it like to be a messenger? It's like, what is it like to be Emily as a messenger?
Yeah, I think that's possibly part of it for me. I'm a little bit sceptical about saying it's a coming-of-age story because I feel like I'm still coming of age and there's so much more to come, and it's not just that one story. And I don't really want to write into the sort of hackneyed old narrative of small-town girl moves to the big city, finds herself, because I don't know, I think arrogantly I feel like there's so much more to my story than that, though effectively that is all there is. But I think it's almost inevitably it was going to be like that, because for me couriering, the big thing is the sense of discovery constantly, and it's discovery of London and of all the little streets you didn't know existed and all the details of those streets and all the little bolt holes where I would sit, and I'm still discovering London now, you know, after living there for 10 years, and then discovering myself and what I can do and how I want to do it and the abilities I had that I didn't know I had and all of that. And that, I think, is that kind of ongoing sense of discovery and not knowing what each day would hold is what kept me going for so long and still makes me really love the job. So I think the only reason I've bothered to write a book is that it was so much part of me, really.
Did messengering change you? I mean, growing up here, it's the great outdoors is all around you. I'd imagine you'd had quite a sort of physical childhood. Did you know you were fit, strong, able to do these amazing things with your body, riding your bike, and I don't know what else, what other things you're going to do in the future? Or was that something that you discovered through the hard miles on London streets?
I was a major bookworm as a child, and at least some of the time I was just locked in my room with Enid Blyton, or I was sitting in the library at school or skiving off games and whatnot. And I think I became a bit of a slug in my teenage years. But there were other points in my life where I was active, and I would spend a lot of time on my own as a kid, running up in the hills and, you know, falling out of trees and nearly drowning in rivers and things my mother probably wouldn't want to know about. So there was all that. And I did a bit of cycling with my father when I was younger. And for 10 years, my greatest physical achievement was that I had cycled 80 miles in a day when I was 14. And until I was 24, I didn't do that again. And I thought, that's probably the pinnacle of my physical achievement in my life. And I was really proud of myself for having done that, but thought that was pretty much it. And it was wonderful to get back on the bike when I was 24 and start taking it seriously again and knock out 80 miles in a day again, and then knock out 100 miles and then 200 miles. And, you know, it wasn't all over at that point. So I did always have it in me, but I think I didn't always use it.
Was it discovering the bicycle, or was it being a messenger that made you fit and strong and able to do those kind of rides? Because I remember asking Bill Chidley, Buffalo Bill, on the bike show, must be 10 years ago when we did a rolling interview, whether bike messengers were fit, whether they were fitter than, you know, your average club racing cyclist. And he was like, no, they're not. You know, not compared to a club cyclist. They do a certain number of miles, but it's not the same sort of thing. You've done the Transcontinental Race. I mean, that is an extremely demanding event. It's an unsupported race across Europe. The clock doesn't stop ticking and you're doing hundreds of miles a day, and all your other sort of touring exploits. How did messengering lead you into that kind of extreme cycling?
I think it's not so much the fitness, although I mean, I'm now fitter than I've been in my life and really enjoying it. And it took a few years for me to realise I actually was objectively fit. And now I'm looking at it as this sort of toy I can play with. Like, oh, I've got all this fitness. What can I do with it? But I think really what has suited me so well for the touring and then the quite difficult touring and then the racing is the endurance aspect. Because as a courier, you're on your bike 5 days a week and you've got to get up every morning and get on the bike no matter what, and you've got to do it all day long. And although you're not riding all the time, because, you know, you have breaks in between jobs, sometimes there's no work for an hour, the stopping and starting, I think, actually makes it harder, because your body is kind of, there are greater peaks and troughs. It's not just like you wind yourself up to a nice steady 18 miles an hour and keep going. You are sprinting and then you're braking and then you're stopping and then you're resting and then you're starting again, and that's exhausting. So I think that gives you a particular kind of fitness, but I think it's more the sort of the day after day after day thing. And I'm used to riding when I'm tired and ill and hungry and hungover and I've got saddle sore and I've got period pain and I wish I wasn't there. And you get used to just getting on with it.
So that's the kind of mental side of it, the mental toughness.
I suppose it probably is. I mean, I don't think there's any difference in my muscles that enables me to do that. I think it is, it's the habit. I don't even know if it's mental toughness. It's just, it's being in a certain habit.
When you've done things a few times, you kind of know that you can do them again. And when you do reach the difficult moment, you know that actually if you just keep on going, it'll pass, which is a weird feeling. And it's a feeling that I think a lot of people discover through Audax events, sort of 200 kilometres and upwards, that feeling that you do ride through the bit where you feel like you should stop.
You've got to remind yourself when you're having a bad time, this won't last. And when you're having a good time, that won't last either. It's just about being willing to go with the weakness and the strength as they come up. And I think learning to be an ultra racer and learning to just keep going, in my case, it's not necessarily about exercising my brain like a muscle. I think that might be a misconception. I think it might just be about learning about your own mental landscape and thinking, oh, hey, okay, here comes a period of weakness. I'll just kind of sit through this and keep going, and then I'll feel great. And here comes a period of crying, but it's okay because I've been here before and it didn't last then and it won't last now. And knowing that you need to deal with the hunger and the tiredness and all of that. But ultimately, you just keep going, and you can keep going through anything.
This world is like a mirror. Reflect on what you do. And if you face it smiling, it will smile right back to you. So do unto others as you would have them do, so that your days many, many years, much longer. And I know that it was the voice, it was the voice of the Most High. And I know.
Well, we're back at your place, Emily, and that was a terrific ride. No more crashes or collisions on the way back down, I'm glad to say. And here we are at your bike shed.
Such as it is, it's actually the garage. It's got a bit more other stuff in it than bikes, but it's got all of my current
bikes.
Should we step
inside? I think it's always good to have a bit of bike shed on the bike show.
One at the back here.
Yeah.
This one is my Genesis Datum, which I did the Transcontinental.
Oh, right. Yeah, you've got to tell us all about the Transcontinental. This is the ride, unsupported ride, from Belgium to Istanbul last year. I think they're changing the route slightly for this year. And you basically just go and have to look after yourself and follow this absurd route past all these inaccessible checkpoints that are at the top of mountains.
Well, there's no actual route. You just have to go through the checkpoints. So broadly speaking, people followed the same sort of route between the checkpoints, but you can make up your own route as much as you like.
But it's not a direct route from Belgium to Istanbul by any means.
No. They put in a lot of wiggles. So first we had to go due south, and then we had to double back northeast. And it was, I didn't do the whole thing. I dropped out on day eight with mysterious chest pains, but it was brutally hard, but I really enjoyed it. I can't talk about it without a smile on my face. And it's really hard to explain why. It's a bit like asking why I was so into couriering. I don't know, but I just enjoyed it so much and I want to do it
again. Because you're basically riding all the time and sleeping how much a day?
It varied. The first few nights I would have maybe, I think the first night I had 3 hours. The second night, I think I had 90 minutes. I was lying down, not sleeping for a while. And then by the end of it, I was a bit anorexic with sleep and I was sort of allowing myself 10 minutes here and there, which ultimately I think led to my downfall. So I'm going to work on that for next year. But yeah, it's you just cycle. And they say any time spent not cycling, eating or sleeping is wasted. And so I would sort of have my dinner in McDonald's or something, or have a pizza and then kind of sit there. And occasionally you'd sort of think, so what now? And then you realise, no, just cycle. Just keep cycling. If you're not cycling, you're doing it wrong. So just keep cycling.
So the bike, it's a very stealthy black bike. You've got tri-bars on there. This is what you'd call a sort of endurance road gravel crossover type of bike, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. This is a new Genesis bike. I'm not sure exactly how they're defining it. But this is one of the gravel plus bikes. So it's kind of a road bike geometry. But it's got wider clearance for, as you see, I've got the fairly big tyres on.
And it's made out of carbon fibre.
It is, yeah. So it's super light. It's very, very robust. This one I've discovered, it's actually a bit small for me, so I haven't ridden it for a while. And I'll probably be on a different one next year. I've got a a steel bike on the way, which will be heavier than this, but I really like riding steel, so I might go back to
Yeah, would you recommend this bike to people on the basis of your experiences on the Transcontinental?
I would, because it handled beautifully, especially on the gravel section, which I was quite worried about not being much of an off-roader. But I would say get the right size, because that might be where I fell down. So yeah, this one hasn't seen much action for a little while. And what I'm mostly riding now is further over to the front. So this is my other Genesis, which is a carbon 0.4. And it's just a lovely bike.
So this is a road bike?
Yeah, this is just a sort of straight road bike. And this is what I go out on most days if I'm on the road. And it's just such a joy to ride. It's so light. And I haven't had a road bike for years. So until about a year ago, all I had was a fat bike and a fixie. And so I could do the long, slow things on the fat bike and I could nip around London on the fixie. But I didn't really have anything in between. So for a while, I was doing all my long rides on fixed, which was sort of an added level of difficulty. And I was dreaming of getting a road bike, but, you know, couldn't afford one and couldn't really justify one. And so now having road bikes in my stable, it's just given me this new lease of bike, really.
Yeah, I mean, I spend most of my time on touring bike and or sometimes a mountain bike like today, and when I do ride the road bike, it does almost feel like cheating. It's so smooth and fast and easy feeling.
Yeah, it really does, but it's lovely. It's lovely zipping up the hills on this. You know, I sometimes, there's a few loops I go out with a lot of climbing, and on a good day, you just feel like you're in a Rafa advert. It's amazing.
And so this is the much neglected, I'd imagine, Joe Waugh fixed gear bicycle that you had as a messenger.
It is, yeah.
Because I don't imagine it gets an awful lot of use round here with the hills and the muddy tracks around here.
It doesn't. It has in the past, and I have done some pretty decent climbing on this. But now I've got the road bikes, of course. This is not getting much of a look in. Though I had it down in London for the last couple of weeks for my book launch, and I was staying in Harrow, so riding in and out of town an hour each way every day. And it's lovely. I miss this bike so much. It's basically my favourite bike. It's a lovely old steel frame. I love riding fixed. The geometry suits me.
But it's not a track bike, so it's a road bike. So you could put some gears on it.
I could.
And you could bring it to life in Wales. It's got a nice two-colour neon orange and yellow two-colour fade paint job.
Well, I could, but I'm not going to. I love having a fixed bike in my stable. I really, really love riding fixed. And I think if I toughen up a bit in future years, I'll be doing some of the longer rides on fixed.
Mm. And then lurking behind it is a very strange-looking bike. What is this? This is a Cannondale weird lefty fork, kind of mono fork thing.
Yeah, this
is a strange mountain bike.
This is a borrowed mountain bike. This isn't actually mine. I've got this on loan for me to practice, because one of the unexpected things that has happened this year is that I have started to get into off-roading, which I thought I never would.
It's the move back to Wales. It happens to everyone. You can't spend time as someone who rides bikes in Wales without getting back into off-roading. It's just not possible.
Well, I think it was Scotland that did it, because I spoke at the Edinburgh Bike Festival and they signed me up for this event going on that week, the Capital Trail, which was a 200k off-road loop of Edinburgh outside the city. And I think they just thought, oh, well, Emily Chappell, you know, she's into cycling, she'll be fine, not realising that I had zero off-road experience. So I borrowed this bike then, in fact, and did that ride, pretty much trebled my off-road experience in just a few hours, and really loved it.
And are you going to do the Transcontinental 2016?
Oh yeah, definitely.
And how are you going to, so have you been training over the winter? You know, what are you going to do to get to the end this time?
I think you catch me now at pretty much my lowest ebb. So I didn't recover properly after last year, so I think I'm still a little bit sort of impaired, and I've had a virus over the winter. So right now I just feel like I'm never going to ride a bike again. It'll be terrible. But it's all going to ramp up from here.
How do you train for that kind of extreme undertaking?
Well, that in itself is quite interesting, because it's quite a new sport and there's not really much of a sort of accepted training discipline around ultra cycling. So some people will train by doing a lot of big rides, and that's what I did last year. I just would go up and down to Manchester and things like that, and practice doing 300k and 400k and 600k, did a couple of Audaxes and get used to doing that. But what some people are telling me is if you do too much of that, you'll just exhaust yourself. You can actually get fit doing a lot less. You just need to work on the fitness. So I'm not really sure. I really like the long rides. So I'd quite like to do a few more 600s this year. But I do think I want to be careful about conserving my energy and not knackering myself. One thing I'm going to be doing is just doing my entire book tour by bike. So, you know, if I have an event in Cardiff one day and Manchester the other, then that will be a nice long bike ride.
And will you be riding to win?
Obviously, I would like to win. I've no idea if I stand a chance of winning. And it seems a bit sort of risky to say, yes, I'm riding to win.
Do you know who your rivals are?
As far as I know, I think my main rivals will be Jane Wadsworth, who was the only woman who finished last year, although she didn't officially finish because she was meant to be part of a pair, but she did finish. And she is brilliant. And I basically punched the air when I found out she was in it this year. So I think she will be a very interesting rival. And then I think Fran Kuhner is doing it. And she was Fran Hollander. She has done the Trans Am and... I think she started to do the round the world race, but didn't manage to finish. So she'll be in it, I think. And she, I think, will be also quite interesting. And then apparently there are quite a few other women, but I don't yet know who. So there's probably going to be a few unknowns as well. So I think it will be interesting because this year, by the time I dropped out, I was pretty much the only woman left in the race, which meant in a way, if I'd finished, I could have said I'd won. And I would have liked that, but it wouldn't really have meant very much. You can't really win if you're the only person. It doesn't really count. You know, I could have come in a month after the main winner and said I'd won. So it only really means something if you've got a decent women's field. And hopefully this year we'll have that.
Do you ever see yourself riding as a messenger again? Or is that part of your past and not part of your future?
I think it has sort of become part of my past without my really meaning it. I kind of organically reached the end of my career about a year ago. I wouldn't say no. And there is, if I had the opportunity to maybe do a couple of weeks or a month on circuit, then I would love to. I love so much about it. I would really, really love to do it. And it would be in some ways just like coming home and, you know, slotting back into my old life. But having thought I would never move on, I think I have moved on.
If you were to do that, will there still be a circuit to go back to? What is the future of the bike messenger in London and other big cities around the world? It does seem as though there's a lot of disruptive technology now. You've got Uber disrupting the taxis. Is that going to happen? Are we going to have drones flying packages around? Are people going to stop wanting to send packages?
It's an interesting question, and I can't speak very authoritatively for the health of the circuit right now because I'm not on it and haven't been for a year. And when I was last in London last week, I saw far fewer couriers than I would normally have expected to. But there has been this narrative throughout the entire time I've been a courier and before then of the circuit being in terminal decline, and it's a dying industry and email has killed it off and everything else. But it hasn't died yet. And there are some people in some companies who are still doing quite well. And I think my take on it is that it will not die, but it will change. And some people, some strands of it will die off. Some people will get out. Some people won't like it anymore and will not want to be messengers anymore. And it could be that the days of the, you know, the spiky young man with the tattoos might not make it. But I think there will always be people delivering things by bikes. And I think there will always be things that need to be delivered by bikes.
And if you were giving advice to someone who maybe read your book and thinks, God, that looks like the life for me, what would you say? Should they do it?
I would say definitely do it. You know, the worst thing that happens is that you'll turn out not to like it and then you can just quit, which is very easily done, and go and do something else, go back to what you were doing before. And then if you do get into it, my advice would be keep your options open, keep other fingers in other pies, keep your foot out the door, because you need to have other options. It's for most people, it's not going to be your career. And if you get stuck in it, that could be quite hard.
I was riding with Emily Chappell, and her book, What Goes Around, is published by Faber and Faber. Well, that's it for another edition of The Bike Show. Thanks for sticking with the podcast. Look out for a more regular service in the weeks and months ahead. Until the next time, From me, Jack Thurston. Goodbye.